betrayal, as I call it, there are going to be immediate and noticeable impacts.
Democrats want to make President Trump's massive tax and spending package a focus of the midterms. What's their strategy?
For Thursday, July 3rd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Trump administration restored the names of some military bases named for Confederate generals by finding other people with the same last names.
What the law says is you can't commemorate Confederates. I think it breaks the spirit of the law, but I'm not sure that it breaks the law.
And the soccer world is mourning after a Liverpool star died in a car crash.
There were millions of Liverpool fans, but also football fans, non-fans, who will also be shocked by this.
Also, a look at the health benefits of napping
after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. After months of bitter Republican infighting, President Trump's massive tax cut and spending package is now on its way to his desk. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports the bill overcame several close calls to win final passage in the House today.
The mega bill faced its final hurdles in the Republican-led House, where a group of GOP holdouts stalled a key vote for nearly 20 hours before eventually folding and setting up final passage. House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries stalled that final vote for several hours, railing on the House floor against the plan's Medicaid cuts and other controversial provisions. Passage of President Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill consumed the Republican-led Congress for months. Now, Trump is expected to sign the legislation in the coming hours, moving the fight from Congress to the campaign trail. Democrats say they'll make the plan a centerpiece of next year's midterm election in their bid to take back control of Congress. Claudia Grisales, NPR News.
President Trump is headed to Iowa as part of America 250, a full year of events celebrating the country's 250th anniversary. As NPR Stephen Fowler reports, he'll be speaking tonight at the Iowa State Fairgrounds.
Trump's speech kicks off a year-long celebration that organizers are calling a new era of American greatness. And he's expected to announce more details about proposals for celebrating the semi-quincentennial anniversary next year, including a Great American State Fair. But he'll also use the speech to tout his second-term policy agenda, including the newly passed mega bill that will increase federal deficits and extend tax cuts while also cutting health care and social services. Stephen Fowler, NPR News.
Hiring held steady last month. Employers in the U.S. added 147,000 jobs in June, more than economists were expecting. And the unemployment rate dipped to 4.1%. NPR's Scott Horsley has more.
Job gains were concentrated last month in health care and state and local government. The federal government continued to shed jobs, cutting 7,000 positions last month. Factories also cut about 7,000 jobs in June. The manufacturing sector has been hard hit by President Trump's tariffs. Otherwise, hiring held steady last month, roughly matching the pace of the last year. Job gains for April and May were also revised up. Average wages last month were up 3.7% from a year ago, which is likely more than enough to outpace inflation. The solid job market likely means the Federal Reserve will not be in a hurry to cut interest rates, despite jawboning from Trump, who wants to see lower borrowing costs. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Wall Street higher by the close on this shortened holiday trading day. The Dow up 344 points, the Nasdaq up 207, S&P 500 up 51. You're listening to NPR News. The Supreme Court says it will hear lower court rulings in favor of transgender athletes in Idaho and West Virginia next fall. This 2 weeks after the high court upheld a ban on certain gender-affirming treatments for transgender youth. More than two dozen states have enacted laws restricting transgender women and girls from participating in certain sports. Some of these laws have been blocked in court. Actor Michael Madsen has died. He was 67 years old. He was best known for his collaborations with Quentin Tarantino, including 1992's Reservoir Dogs. His representative says he was found unresponsive in his home following a cardiac arrest. And NPR's Andrew Limbong has this appreciation.
You ever listen to Kay Billy's Super Sounds of the 70s?
In Reservoir Dogs, Michael Madsen was soft-spoken and yet terrifying, as exemplified by this now classic scene involving Madsen's character, Mr. Blonde, a tied-up policeman, a straight razor, and an ear.
Hey, what's going on? You hear that?
Madsen kept working with Tarantino after this in Kill Bill and The Hateful Eight. Overall, Madsen had more than 300 credits to his name across film, TV, and video games. He had multiple feature films in the works yet to be released, and according to his representatives, Madsen was also working on a new book before he died titled Tears for My Father, Outlaw Thoughts and Poems. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
Crude oil prices lower by the close, falling 0.4%. 10 the day at $67.14 a barrel. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Programming on KAXE KBXE is supported in part by the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, serving Minnesota veterans and their families by connecting them to both federal and state benefits and services they have earned. More information is online at minnesotaveteran.org, and thank you for your service. Now back to All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Since his second swearing-in, or even before, President Trump has pushed for a massive piece of legislation that would wrap up many of his administration's priorities with one tidy bow. Well, today, he got his wish. House Republicans passed that massive tax and policy bill, delivering to the president what he wanted by his preferred deadline, the 4th of July. Here's House Speaker Mike Johnson.
Today, we are making the dream of a government that puts the American people first a reality.
The legislation extends Trump's 2017 tax cuts and boosts spending on border security and defense. It also cuts spending across a range of programs, most notably Medicaid. Democrats voted in unison against the bill, but while they speak with one voice to voters ahead of the midterms, to shine some light on their 2026 strategy, I spoke with Ken Martin, chair of the Democratic Party, shortly before the vote.
Well, look, let me just start with how devastating this bill is. Look, these cowardly Republicans, most of them who, haven't met with their constituents, they refuse to meet with their constituents, right, and who tried to pass this bill in the middle of the night. Thank God that Hakeem Jeffries gave his record-breaking speech today to make these Republicans actually vote in broad daylight, right? We're, at the end of the day, these Republicans betrayed their constituents. They put their fealty to Donald Trump and the Republican Party and his billionaire friends ahead of the constituents that they were elected by, right? And this betrayal is immense, right? They betrayed seniors in their districts who now, thanks to this bill passing, a quarter of nursing homes are going to close around the country, and we're literally going to be booting seniors out of their nursing homes. They betrayed children. Over 3 million children throughout this country who rely on SNAP benefits are going to go without food now. They betrayed the disabled. 17 million Americans now, right? The largest reduction ever in our country's history in healthcare are going to be kicked off of their health insurance because of this bill. So for me, we're going to hang this vote around the neck of every single Republican who decided to sell their constituents out to help billionaires.
Explain to me how so, though, because I've covered politics for a long time, and historically, Republicans have been pretty good at selling a message. For example, this is a bill that is widely known as the Big Beautiful Bill, even though I will note this is not something that will be beautiful for all Americans. So what can members of your party tell their constituents that is as concise and compelling as that, that can explain to people the message that you have?
It's not beautiful. There's nothing beautiful about this bill. At the end of the day, this is the most unpopular piece of legislation in the last half century. Majority of Americans, not majority of Democrats, majority of Americans do not favor this bill. It is a gift for the Democratic Party, right? Because let me tell you, many people who left our party, they bought this snake oil salesman's message that he was going to actually improve their lives and strengthen communities. He hasn't delivered at all on any of that. And that gives us an opportunity as a Democratic Party, if we're willing to take it. And I'll tell you what, we are willing to take that opportunity to actually expand our coalition and bring many of those people back into the conversation and back into our party.
I've got to ask you about a bit of polling. According to the latest NPR PBS News Marist poll, the approval rating for congressional Democrats is at just 27%. That is down from 39% last February. How do you and your fellow Democrats make the case to the American public that they can trust you and that they can support the party?
Well, I think it's a fair point, right? We have to earn the trust of voters back. And there's no doubt that there were a number of people over not just this last election, but many elections who've left our party because they don't feel like we're fighting for them anymore. And, you know, actually last year there was some research that showed, surprisingly, it should have been the canary in the coal mine, that for the first time in American history, the majority of Americans believe that the Republican Party best represents the interest of the middle class, the working class, and the poor, and the Democratic Party is the party of the wealthy and the elites, right? Well, boy, this vote today actually proves that it's just the opposite, right? And that is what I'm talking about, is for us to earn the trust back of these voters, we have to stand up and fight for them again. And we have to give them a sense of what our economic agenda is and what it would mean if they put Democrats back in power versus this, you know, Republican administration who's made it clear that they could give a damn about working people in this country and they're certainly not going to fight for them. So I do think, you know, look, we've got work to do. There's no doubt about it, right? But I've always said this, when you hit rock bottom, guess what? There's only one direction to go, and it's up. And that's what we're doing. And certainly this bill is going to supercharge that because people are going to be pissed off around this country.
But there's polling out there that suggests that a number of Americans are not actually familiar of the details of what is in this legislation. It is a mammoth bill, even for those of us who track it incredibly closely. So it seems like that could present a challenge for your party in defining it and making sure that people know the details that you feel are not a good deal for the American people. How do Democrats do that?
Yeah, I mean, we have to get out there. It's why we just launched our organizing summer campaign, right? Making sure that we are actually getting into the spaces where voters are at, right? Not just the traditional spaces, the news and media, but going to picnics, going to sporting events, you know, going to book clubs, you know, making sure that we are where voters are at in those, you know, sort of offline spaces. And then making sure in those online spaces that we are meeting voters where they're at and getting the message out so they know exactly how disastrous this bill is. And we have to do that. And we have to do a better job of messaging around them.
We just saw Zohran Mamdani, a Democratic Socialist, win the New York mayoral primary over the establishment candidate Andrew Cuomo. And I'll just note that Mamdani did not have the Democratic Party's support. Does that win make you reconsider your strategy when it comes to backing establishment Democrats in the midterms?
No, listen, my strategy has always been to support whoever our Democratic nominee is, right? And Mamdani is our Democratic nominee, and we will support him. You know, look, we're a big tent party. We have conservative Democrats, we have centrists, we have progressives, and we have leftists, right? And I believe you win elections through addition, not subtraction. You win elections by actually, you know, bringing people into your coalition, not pushing them out. And so for me, there are a lot of lessons to learn from his campaign. One is how disciplined he was on the message. He stayed focused on what people care about, which was affordability. And then also his online and offline presence and how he actually met voters where they were at with a message that was resonant. That's the key to winning for sure. And you know what? We are happy as a Democratic Party to support our nominees wherever they live, no matter what part of the ideological spectrum they're on, we're going to support them. Because guess what? At the end of the day, in my opinion, you know, any Democrat, regardless of their flavor, is better than a Republican any day of the week.
That was Democratic Party Chair Ken Martin. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Maybe you think of napping as a luxury. I certainly do, but there are a lot of health benefits to a daily snooze if you do it right. LifeKit's Andy Tagle has more on the simple steps to a great nap.
The list of potential benefits from napping is a long one.
I like to call it performance-enhancing drug without the drug.
That's Jade Wu, a sleep medicine specialist and researcher based in North Carolina and author of the book Hello Sleep.
It's good for our emotion regulation. It makes us less biased towards negative stimuli, more flexible in our thinking.
And then there are the physical benefits, too.
So athletes will often use a nap to really boost their performance, and they'll find that they have more power, more stamina. They feel fatigue less quickly. Napping really can all around benefit our performance and our overall health.
But all naps are not created equal. Ever woken up from an afternoon snooze and felt even more tired?
Groggy, you're dragging, you're like, where am I? What time is it?
There's a term for that discombobulated feeling, sleep inertia. And it happens when you wake up in the middle of deep sleep. So, how can you make sure your nap will leave you feeling refreshed? It's as simple as CEB.
We want to be consistent, early, and brief.
Let's take each of those one by one. First up, C for consistent.
And by consistent, I mean not haphazardly, sometimes early, sometimes late, sometimes, you know, long, sometimes short.
Wu says, take a page out of some European countries' playbooks and pick a designated time to rest.
If you're going to have a siesta, do it at the same time every day.
Then there's E for early.
Midday, early afternoon would be excellent.
Wu suggests aiming for a nap between noon and 3 p.m. during the day to avoid sabotaging your nighttime sleep. Or for the night owls and shift workers out there, that means napping at least 6 to 8 hours before your primary rest period to give yourself enough time to get sleepy again before bed. Finally, there's B for brief. This one might be painful if you're a fan of a long, leisurely afternoon snooze, but
naps that are too long are, first of all, going to interfere with your nighttime sleep, and we don't want that.
Taking short naps also makes it more likely that you'll stay in the lighter phases of sleep and will be able to avoid that sleep inertia.
We want to keep it at about half an hour, hour at most. If you set a timer for about 45 minutes, give yourself a few minutes to get into sleep, you'll probably end up sleeping about 30-ish minutes. And that's pretty safe. That's good.
From there, it's just about making the time to take that break, which, of course, is easier said than done.
It might take a lot of practice at first because we are conditioned to be always multitasking, always productive, right? It's really hard to actually just rest for 30 minutes in the middle of the day, but it's so crucial.
And yes, that was rest you heard, not sleep. If you're not the napping type, Wu says there's still a lot of benefit in taking a daytime pause.
If I fall asleep, great. If I don't fall asleep, also great. Even if you just kind of hang out in a meditative state, do some mindfulness practices, or even just let your mind wander, those states are really restful and really special and can be rejuvenating in a similar way that a nap can be rejuvenating.
For NPR's Life Kit, I'm Andy Tagle.
And for more Life Kit, check out npr.org/lifekit. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is your daily dose of phonology. Support for KAXE comes from Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering tire brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo, serving the area since 1916. More at AtchisonTire.com. Now it's time for your daily dose of phonology with John Latimer.
On today's date, July 3rd, 1988, common tansy has begun to bloom. The flowers on the common tansy remind me of aspirin tablets. They're about that size and about that thick, but they're bright yellow. And the plant itself has a very strong odor. So if you see these clusters of bright yellow disc flowers, each one about the size of an aspirin tablet, take a leaf off and smash it between your fingers, roll it a little bit and smell it, and it's an unmistakable odor. Common tansy was brought to the United States as a medicinal plant. If you administer the oil of the tansy to a pregnant female, it blocks her body's ability to absorb vitamin B. And if it's done in the right dosages, it can result in an abortion. But if you don't have the dosages figured out right, if you're a smaller person with a larger dose, it may just kill you and the fetus. So it's not something to fool around with, but it tells you something about our early ethnobotany.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from BritBox, presenting Outrageous, a new BritBox original drama based on the scandalous true story of England's infamous Mitford sisters. Streaming this and more original series at BritBox.com. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The U.S. Supreme Court dove back into the culture wars full steam today. It agreed to hear two cases in the fall that test state laws banning transgender women and girls from participating in sports at publicly funded institutions. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg joins us now. Hi, Nina.
Hi there.
So how widespread are these state bans?
Something like 27 states have enacted these laws, with supporters saying they're needed to ensure fairness in athletic competition and to prevent trans athletes whose sex at birth was male from having an unfair advantage. Opponents of the laws say they discriminate based on sex and thus that they violate both the Constitution's guarantee to equal protection of the law and Title IX, the federal law enacted in 1972 that mandates equal treatment in all athletic programs receiving federal funds. Mm-hmm. So that covers just about every public school in the country from first grade through college.
Right. Okay. And tell us why this has become such an important issue recently.
Transgender participation in women's sports, though extremely rare, has become the newest flashpoint in the modern culture wars, especially after the Trump presidential campaign last year made transgender participation in many walks of life a huge issue. Upon his taking office this year, Trump immediately delivered, issuing executive orders to ban transgender women and girls from sports, in addition to ordering all trans individuals out of the military and requiring trans individuals getting a passport to list their sex at birth, not their transgender.
Well, how many transgender women and girls are currently playing sports at all levels? Do we know?
Very few. At least the NCAA chair, Charlie Baker, told a Senate panel last year that the number is fewer than 10.
Huh.
It's rare and often uneventful, especially with younger children and even older ones who play club sports. And remember that the number of transgender people in the general population is under 1%. But when it gets to big-time competition in the NCAA and the Olympics, mm-hmm. it gets a lot more complicated. In fact, one of the briefs filed in this case is signed by 102 female athletes and family members who side with the states in these cases, saying it's just not fair to have a person born as a boy with greater strength and speed competing against a woman or girl. And it's interesting to see who some of the people are on that brief, including members of the LGBTQ community like former tennis star Martina Navratilova and female Olympics champions. And late last year, several big-time collegiate women's volleyball teams actually forfeited matches against San Jose State, refusing to play them because one of their players was a transgender woman.
Right. Well, what are the NCAA rules on all of this?
Well, all the big sports associations, including the NCAA, the U.S. Soccer Federation, the Olympic Committee, they all allowed most trans athletes to compete, though they often required proof that the athletes were taking hormones or puberty blockers. And trans athletes almost never prevailed or dominated until a few aced out young women who otherwise would have won medals. Of course, that's changed since the Trump executive order.
And real quick, Nina, I mean, during this past term at the Supreme Court, the justices upheld state laws that ban gender-affirming care for transgender minors. Given that, what do you think the prospects are for this case in the next term?
I would say that the hints from the opinions in that case are pretty strong in favor of the states banning transgender athletes.
That is NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Thank you, Nina.
Thank you.
The Trump administration restored the names of 9 bases named after Confederate generals by finding other people with the same last names. While the move is probably legal, advocates say it dishonors a bipartisan attempt to turn the page on the military's segregationist past. Steve Walsh with WHRO in Norfolk, Virginia, has the story.
Lieutenant General Arthur Gregg was the first African-American to reach the rank of lieutenant general in the Army. In 2023, the 94-year-old received the rare honor of having a base named after him while he was still alive. I spoke with him shortly after the naming ceremony.
I think the success in the Army's integration of African-Americans and other minorities has been a powerful influence in the wider society of America.
When Gregg was stationed at Fort Robert E. Lee in 1950, he was denied access to the base's segregated officers club. In 2023, the club was renamed for him and Lieutenant Colonel Charity Adams. She headed the only unit of African-American women to deploy overseas during World War II.
I recognize that having my name on a major Army installation imposes additional responsibility on me, but I carry that responsibility with a great deal of pride.
Gregg died in August 2024. Less than a year later, the Trump administration stripped his name from the base and did the same thing at eight other bases, finding new names which mimicked those of Confederate generals that Congress had ordered be changed. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth explained the rationale to Congress in a heated exchange with Senator Tim Kaine, who questioned why they were removing the names of three bases in Virginia.
Senator, as you know, this was never about the names of the bases they were renamed to.
So you don't challenge all bases to their original names. We're not about erasing history.
In fact, his office came up with a way to sidestep a law that forbids the Pentagon from naming anything to honor the Confederacy. Retired Army Brigadier General Ty Sejuli co-chaired the renaming commission, which chose the new names from 33,000 suggestions.
We had buried the Confederate names in 2023, and he has unearthed those traitors, I think, even if they're zombies.
The new letterhead for Gregg Adams lists the home of Army logistics simply as Fort Lee. The new namesake is supposed to be Fitz Lee, a black soldier awarded the Medal of Honor after the Spanish-American War. Adding to the confusion, Fitz Lee was also the name of a Confederate cavalry officer who was the nephew of Robert E. Lee.
What the law says is you can't commemorate Confederates. I think it breaks the spirit of the law, but I'm not sure that it breaks the law.
They did not send us because they thought we could do it. We are here because they are sure we cannot.
Lieutenant Colonel Adams is among the most prominent names being removed. After being largely unheralded after World War II, her unit, the 6888, is the subject of a recent Hollywood movie starring Kerry Washington.
The entire 6888 are great American patriots, loyal to a nation that for far too long failed to return that favor.
In April, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson presided over the ceremony to award the unit the Congressional Gold Medal. So far, the Army has not announced a dedication ceremony for the newly redesignated Fort Lee. For NPR News, I'm Steve Walsh.
This is NPR News.
The U.S. dollar has been the talk of the global economy this year. As it comes off its worst start since 1973, experts are wondering if the currency's reign is over.
The dollar has been king of the hill for a long time, and maybe it's been coming off a bit from its peak for the last decade.
We talk about what to expect with a weak dollar, plus listeners describe what freedom means to them. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. Coming up next is National Native News. We receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com. Bemidji JC's 81st Annual Water Carnival is going on now through July 6th. The Grand Parade is Sunday, July 6th at 1 p.m. Find a full schedule at bemidjijcs.com. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Now it's time for National Native News here on KAXE KBXE.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. In a 6-3 ruling this week, the Oklahoma Supreme Court says a Native citizen living on her reservation isn't exempt from state income tax. The Journal Record reports that Alicia Strobel, a member of the Muskogee Nation, had argued that her income was exempt because she lived and worked on her tribe's land. In 2020, Strobel had filed 3 Oklahoma individual income tax returns for the 3 previous years. She said the U.S. Supreme Court decision in the case McGirt versus Oklahoma supported her stance, as that ruling reaffirmed the existence of the Muskogee Nation's reservation. 2 years later, the Oklahoma Tax Commission denied her exemption, leading to an appeal and the case making it up to the state's highest court. The definition of Indian country was deliberated in oral arguments last year. The Oklahoma justices said McGirt doesn't apply to state tax law. In an opinion, they said that extending McGirt to preempt Oklahoma from taxing the income of tribal members residing on unrestricted, non-trust private fee land must come from the nation's highest court. Governor Kevin Stitt praised the ruling, saying he rejects race-based tax exemptions. Tribal leaders have denounced the ruling as inconsistent and a form of legal gymnastics. The Muskogee Nation said they are reviewing their next steps. Several coastal Arctic communities hosted festivals throughout June to celebrate a successful whaling season. In Ukagavik, that meant 4 full days of sharing food, prayers, dance, and traditional blanket toss. It also meant gathering as a community in joy and in loss. Alona Nyden with the Alaska Desk has more. And a note to listeners, the story discusses suicide.
Whaler Quincy Adams soars above a seal blanket at Simmons Field in Utqiagvik with a bag of candy in his hands. He leaps even higher and tosses the kaleidoscope of sweets as the children around him whoop with joy and catch treats. Adams is one of the captains of the Olig whaling crew. They were among those who landed a bowhead whale this spring and threw a feast for the community.
Make sure everybody gets a bite to eat. Make sure that nobody goes hungry.
Nalukatak, which means blanket toss in Inupiaq, is a traditional celebration of the successful bowhead harvest. The whaling crews serve several courses of subsistence dishes throughout the event. Caribou, duck and geese soup, donuts, boiled whale meat, muktuk, akutak, and the delicacy, fermented whale meat and blubber, or mikigak. When the feast is over, the whalers stretch a sealskin blanket, inviting everyone to jump on it. Then the crowd moves indoors and continues with the Inupiaq dancing and drumming throughout the night. This year's Nalukatak had an emotional side for Adams. A young member of their crew died by suicide earlier this year, and the crew opened the event with a prayer and a message of hope.
This is something we wanted to get out to the other people and to the young people and the teens, tell them that there is hope. There is family that loves them, and if they need to talk to somebody, talk to somebody.
Whaling Captain Herman Aksuak says that dedicating Nalukataks to those who passed is not new. He says the event is about the community coming together.
You put on the blanket and jump and let it all out on the blanket and just jump for joy.
The communities of Wainwright, Kaktovik, Nuiqsut, and Point Hope also celebrated whaling festivals in June. In Anchorage, I am Alona Nyden.
If you or someone you know is in crisis, call or text the 988 Suicide Crisis Lifeline. And this Saturday, Minnesota's first ever Native American Food Truck Festival kicks off in St. Paul. Minneapolis St. Paul Magazine says more than 20 Native food trucks will serve up both traditional and urban indigenous fair foods at Harriet Island Regional Park. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Arctic Encounter 2025. an Arctic policy and business event July 30th to August 1st that explores community resilience, critical infrastructure, and traditional knowledge. Registration at arcticencounter.com. Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at aarp.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
At melvilletrust.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington, where House Republicans just passed President Trump's tax and spending bill and sent it to his desk for a signature. The bill cuts nearly $1 trillion from Medicaid spending over the next 10 years. The White House and Congress drove the legislation, but trimming the federal budget and shrinking the size of the federal government are consistent with the vision of Project 2025 co-author and Office of Management and Budget Director Russell Vogt.
All of the nonpartisan federal agencies that exist in the federal government, staffed largely by civil servants, technocrats, bureaucrats, he believes that that was never in the vision of the founders, that it's unconstitutional, and that to return to the vision of the founding fathers, that those agencies should either be eliminated or effectively politicized.
That's Atlantic Magazine staff writer McKay Coppins. He wrote a recent profile of Vogt, and I spoke to him yesterday about the OMB director's agenda.
You know, if you were to listen to Vogt's speeches over the years or read his essays as I have, you would see a strain of he would call fiscal conservatism, right? I think that the so-called Big Beautiful Bill targets some elements of the government that people like Vogt see as too woke or you know, insufficiently conservative. But the reality is that the most kind of radical part of Vogt's ideological project is not any one set of specific cuts. It's his long-term vision for who should control the federal government.
Now, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, the cuts in this bill could lead to nearly 12 million people losing their health insurance in 10 years. How do these cuts, if you can address this, to health care align with Vogt's overarching vision of the government?
Vogt has said in the past that he is convinced that one out of every $5 or $6 of spending in Medicaid is improper spending. I should say that experts and fact checkers have said that there's no basis for that belief, that to the degree that there is any kind of fraud or abuse in the Medicaid program, it's a much smaller percentage than that. I think that it's not a surprise that Vogt and his allies are going after Medicaid and that they're not particularly, you know, sympathetic to claims that this will lead to wide-scale loss of medical coverage, because they just believe, whether there's basis for it or not, that a lot of this money is going to improper sources and that it's fraudulent and needs to be taken care of.
You know, I do wonder that, given that the Congressional Budget Office found that the Republican tax and spending bill would add roughly $3 trillion to the deficit over the next decade, do you get a sense of how Vogt thinks about the nation's debt?
Well, this is kind of the most striking thing about this bill, and it kind of puts the lie to the idea that this is fiscal conservatism at work, right?
Right.
Which raises the question of what exactly Vogt is trying to accomplish here. Is it really trying to, you know, shrink the deficit, or is he trying to unravel the federal government and kind of rebuild a new constitutional order? I would think that the latter is a better description of his ideological project based on the things that he's said and written. And I should also add, he has not been especially coy about this. You know, just a few years ago, he wrote an essay in which he argued that we are living in a, quote, post-constitutional time, and that the right needs to throw off the precedents and legal paradigms that have developed over the last 200 years. So he is pretty upfront about the radicalism of his project.
While so much has happened, I'll just point out we are only halfway through the first year of President Trump's second term. What do you think that's going to focus on next?
In talking to some of his ideological allies, like Steve Bannon, for example, who is a big fan of what Vote is doing, they believe that some of the biggest provocations are yet to come. He is a big believer in the idea of presidential impoundment power, which is to say that the president can effectively cut congressionally mandated federal spending unilaterally without congressional approval. And some of the big fights over that are probably going to come this fall. I think Vote is going to be looking to pick fights with Congress and the judiciary in hopes that these fights will effectively end with the president having much more power than he did before.
McKay Coppins is a staff writer at The Atlantic. His piece is called The Visionary of Trump 2.0. McKay, thank you.
Thank you.
The world of soccer has been left heartbroken by the tragic death of Liverpool star Diogo Jota. NPR's Fatima Al-Kassab reports from London.
Less than 2 weeks ago, 28-year-old Diogo Jota had married his long-term girlfriend. Only yesterday, he had posted on Instagram, calling it a day we will never forget. The couple had three children together. He was at the height of his success on the soccer field, just a few months ago lifting up the Premier League trophy he won with Liverpool Football Club and helping Portugal to victory in the final of the UEFA Nations League. Today, soccer fans were shocked and saddened by the news that Diogo Jota had been killed in a car crash in northwestern Spain, along with his brother André. Spanish police say they're investigating the crash, but it's believed the Lamborghini they were in came off the road due to a tyre blowout while overtaking another car. In a statement, Liverpool Football Club said it was devastated by what it called an unimaginable loss. He had played for the club as a forward for 5 seasons. There were condolences and messages of respect from the top of British politics, including from Prime Minister Keir Starmer.
I'm sure I speak for everyone in saying our first thoughts are going to be with his family and his friends in particular. But there are millions of Liverpool fans, but also football fans, non-fans, who will also be shocked by this.
At the club's Anfield Stadium, hundreds of Liverpool fans, as well as supporters of other teams, gathered to lay wreaths, jerseys and scarves in tribute. John Barlow was one of them. He told BBC Radio he had to stop what he was doing at work to come to the stadium and pay his respects.
I come every match, and he was sort of like one of us. He had a bit of something about him. Like a proper old Liverpool player, like, you know, the players we were brought up with. I'm just that broken.
The city's mayor, Steve Rotherham, spoke to the BBC as he joined those laying flowers at Anfield Stadium.
He's not just a footballer. He's part of the wider family, football clubs up and down the breadth of this country. They love the people who put the shirt on, and Diogo Jota was certainly one of those.
Liverpool Town Hall lowered its Union Jack to half-mast, and many of the tributes left to the soccer star referenced Liverpool Football Club's motto, "You'll never walk alone." Fatima Al-Kassab, NPR News, London.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. We receive support from Patterson's Clothing in downtown Bemidji, an apparel retailer serving the Northwoods since 1930. Patterson's feature clothing from brands such as Cool, Patagonia, Darn Tough, and Smart Wool. PattersonsClothing.com. Happy Dancing Turtles Summer Bingo Scavenger Hunt is going on now through July 31st. The challenge is to take photos of items on your bingo card and then submit online. The more bingos you find, the more chances to win a bigger prize. Find more details and register at happydancingturtle.org. The Loon Country Arts Building in Bemidji is closed due to storm damage, but they will hold a creative cafe Saturday, July 5th from 1 to 3 p.m. at Beltrami County History Center. Artist Kathy Sanders will help you create a patriotic tile trivet. Now for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's broadcast, renters in Duluth demand faster repairs, then how cultural traditions are helping to mitigate wildfires, and Minnesota high schools are sending some students to the head of the class. I'm Gracie Jay. Renters in Duluth want to be able to make repairs themselves if landlords don't act quickly enough. Members of Duluth's tenant union submitted a petition in support of the Right to Repair Ordinance to Duluth City Hall. The proposed ordinance would let tenants pay for repairs and deduct the cost from rent if landlords delay action. The group secured about 6,000 signatures supporting the ordinance. Organizers say the measure would help renters address unsafe or unhealthy living conditions more quickly. Supporters hope to get the proposal on the November ballot so voters can decide. Ahead, as fire suppression increases wildfire severity, two Minnesota prescribed fire council members weigh in with insight on wildfire's place in Northwood's culture and ecology. Reporter Maya Hecht has the story.
I remember as a young kid coming home off the bus, walking down our long driveway, and eventually reaching the front yard, and then the front yard is on fire.
Bazil Minigijigabu Panek is an Eagle Clan member of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa.
It's just my dad doing this burning that's cleaning the forest floor. It's fostering a good forest for our sacred relatives and our beings. I understand that what he was doing is helping to protect those forests and also protect ourselves from an intense wildfire.
At the time of this interview, both the Camp House Fire and Jenkins Creek Fire were burning rapidly in northeastern Minnesota, on the opposite shore of Lake Superior from Bazil's childhood memory.
To me, these ongoing fires is displaying the effects of climate change and the increases in heat and drought events that are happening in the state and the Northwoods overall.
Right now, fire is very much perceived as like a public nuisance or some sort of dangerous thing that needs to be heavily regulated.
Lane Johnson is a dendrochronologist at the Cloquet Forestry Center. He studies tree ring records to understand fire history in Upper Great Lakes forests.
In Minnesota and other parts of the Upper Great Lakes, red pine trees can capture this evidence of frequent fire as far back as the tree ring record will take us. Here at the Cloquet Forestry Center where I work, we have samples that show evidence of fire roughly every 10 to 15 years.
And then, around 1900, the tree rings show that fire scar records stop. So what changed?
In 1910, the priorities for how the land is being cared for change, with an emphasis on timber production.
Amidst fear that fire suppression has led to more destructive wildfire seasons over time, Lane and Bazil are part of a council positioned to tactfully return fire to the northern landscape.
Sometimes we're basically fighting fire with fire.
Bazil recalled one Minnesota prescribed fire council meeting in particular between tribal members and federal representatives who were
looking at this huge map sitting on the table, like, what about this area? We need to do a fire history research in this area and that area.
And then a tribal member who had been quiet spoke up.
He pointed to a specific spot on the map. He said, "My grandma told me that she used to burn here." Everybody kind of goes silent. And it's like, oh, his traditional ecological knowledge can inform where, when, and how we're burning.
This is Maya Hecht for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Seniors at more than 400 Minnesota high schools could get college acceptance letters this fall before even applying. The Minnesota Office of Higher Education's Direct Admissions Program allows 50 colleges and universities across the state to proactively admit students at participating schools based on their academic record. Students who receive offers still have to apply if they'd like to attend, but their guaranteed acceptance and their application fees are waived.
A total of 425 high schools will be participating in the 2025-2026 school year. That's 60 more than the year before.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. A large number of authors have a crystal clear message for publishers: keep AI out of the industry. More than 70 writers wrote an open letter recently outlining their issues with the use of AI in the literary world. Their main demand is for publishing houses to never release books that were created by machines, solving the problem of when to use AI, if at all, along with the fear of being replaced by AI, is a challenge dozens of industries are facing. To talk more about that open letter and how many authors are viewing the fight against AI, I'm joined by best-selling romance novelist Jasmine Guillory. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So, Jasmine, as I mentioned, you are among those more than 70 writers who signed on to this letter against the use of artificial intelligence in publishing. Just start by setting this up for us. What are some of the issues that you all are seeing, and what are some of the demands that you have?
The biggest demand that we have is that publishers not use AI in creating books. So that is, ensure that the books that they publish are written by actual humans. But it's more than that. It's that the art that goes on our covers is made by actual humans, that the editors are people, that our copy editors are people. It sounds weird to say that we want humans to be the ones writing and editing and creating books, but that is exactly the main goal of the letter. And I will add that since the letter came out, thousands more authors have joined in and signed.
Was there something that made you feel like you had to sign onto this? Was there an event that happened or a development in your industry that made you realize you wanted to join into this effort?
I think it's just been a lot of little things. Hearing that covers have been made with AI, hearing that publishers have used, for instance, AI translators to translate books of ours into other languages, you know, vice versa.
I mean, one of the things that really struck me as I was reading this letter was the emphasis not just on the writing itself, but the editors, the copy editors, the publicists, the publishers who have helped to care for and develop and launch the books that you and the other authors have written. Can you spell out a bit how AI is impacting these groups?
Yeah, I mean, I think publishing already doesn't have enough people working in it, right? Like, editors are swamped. Copy editors are swamped. Assistants trying to join the industry aren't getting the mentoring that they need because editors have too much work. And now they want to take some of that work and give it to AI, whereas we want more people involved, right? We want publishing to continue to be an industry that is about people creating art, people learning from one another, people talking to one another about it.
One line in the letter that stuck out to me, and I'm going to read it. It says that AI is an enormously powerful tool here to stay with the capacity for real societal benefits, but the replacement of art and artists is not one of them, end quote. You all acknowledge clearly that AI is indeed here to stay, but you also make note of what you all feel it can't replace. The question I guess I have is, given the fact that AI is likely here to stay, do you see a path forward for authors like yourself in working with it? Is it realistic to think that it won't play any role in writing or publishing?
You know, there are lots of things in publishing where AI can make a job faster. If you're putting together a book, I'm sure there are certain things that AI can do to make the kind of machinery of it more efficient. But I think the important thing is that the art part of creating a book is made by humans, and that something that I learned in elementary school is that plagiarism is wrong, right? I feel like
right. We
all kind of learned that in an early stage. I feel like we're all recognizing that, but I think too many people don't recognize that AI is plagiarism, that trying to use our work to create AI works is just theft without giving us either credit or compensation for it.
If the demands that are stated here aren't met by these publishing houses, how do you see that impacting your work, other authors' work?
We're all kind of talking about that internally. I've talked to a lot of authors who have put AI clauses in their contracts to ensure that, you know, there will be actual people working on their books. And I think some of that has to start with a top down, right? It has to start with authors who have power to put that in their contracts, and then trickles down to, you know, debut authors who may not think about it or who may not have the power and are trying to work together for this movement and to help one another.
Author Jasmine Guillory, thank you so much. When NPR first reported on this story, we reached out to all five of the publishing houses named in the letter and received one response ahead of the publication deadline. Simon & Schuster takes these concerns seriously, spokesperson Susanna Lawrence said in a statement. We are actively engaged in protecting the intellectual property rights of our authors.
The actor Michael Madsen has died. You probably know him from his collaborations with the director Quentin Tarantino, like Reservoir Dogs, Kill Bill, and The Hateful Eight. According to his representatives, he was found unresponsive in his Malibu home this morning following cardiac arrest. He was 67 years old. NPR's Andrew Limbong has this appreciation.
Michael Madsen's voice was at its most chilling when it was quiet.
You're telling me she cut her way through 88 bodyguards?
In the Kill Bill movies, Michael Madsen plays Bud, a washed-up bouncer at a mostly empty strip club. He likes his booze, he likes his dip, but he's wise enough to sum up the tricky morals of the revenge plot driving the movie.
That woman deserves her revenge. Deserve to die.
By the way Madsen plays it, you know he's not just going to accept this fate lying down, even before he says,
then again, so does she.
Michael Madsen had more than 300 acting credits to his name across film, TV, and video games, including War Games, Thelma and Louise, Donnie Brasco, and Free Willy. But his breakout role was as Mr. Blonde in Tarantino's directorial debut, Reservoir Dogs. Fans will know exactly which scene I'm about to talk about.
You ever listen to Kay Billy's Super Sounds of the 70s?
But if you haven't seen it, all you gotta know is it involves a straight razor, a policeman tied to a chair, and an ear. But before he gets to the gruesome bits, Madsen's Mr. Blonde takes his time dancing and singing along to the Steeler's Wheel song.
Climb on to the left of me, Joker's to the right, here I am, stuck in the pool with you.
And then he gets down to business.
Hey, what's going on? You hear that?
In a 2018 interview with The Hollywood Reporter, Madsen had mixed feelings about being typecast as these hard, intimidating characters. Quote, "It's a great blessing to have that, and at the same time, it is really hard to get out of it, and people don't want you to get out of it." But he had other outlets of creativity. Madsen was also a poet with multiple collections. According to his representatives, before he died, he was working on an upcoming book titled Tears for My Father, Outlaw Thoughts and Poems. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji. Huff's congregation strives to build bridges with the community and welcomes all to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. The Northern Lights Music Festival is going on now through July 24th. presenting classical and opera music at various venues on the Iron Range. Find a full schedule at northernlightsmusic.org. Weather tonight, slight chance of showers and thunderstorms, partly cloudy, lows around 70. Tomorrow, 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. Otherwise, it should be mostly sunny, highs in the low 90s, southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Good chance for showers and thunderstorms at night.
Yays are 218, the nays are 214.